Hey everybody, you're listening to The Lost Episode, episode 404, Not Found. As an internet-inspired joke, I decided not to post this episode. So if you're listening to it now, then you are either resourceful and found it by name and number yourself, or I've forgotten that I didn't post it and I've put it in some really obvious public place and you're finding it years and years later, which is just as likely. Anyway, this is Klaatu, and this is episode 404 of my podcast. I don't really have a topic for this episode. It's a lost episode. It's 404. I can say whatever I want. So 403, if you listen to that, you'll know that I talked about Seacache and... No. 403 was Bison and Flex. 405 is about Seacache and Common Lisp. Both very good episodes. A lot more detailed, I think, than I even expected from myself. You should go listen to those sometime. But the series that I'm doing right now in the show is just going through every single package in Slackware. So this isn't going to be that. That's the point. This is out of sequence, out of time, because it is a bonus lost episode. Intentionally lost. 404. I think I'm going to muse a little bit about the quote-unquote early days of Linux. And when I say early days of Linux, I'm going to say that those are my early days of Linux. And I've told some of these stories before on other episodes, but I'm collating them here and adding a couple more things in. And this is completely useless information. It's just me talking about stuff. But my idea here is, I guess, that there's a little bit of history to this. And I don't know that I'll ever write this history down, but I feel like getting it in audio form is basically as good. And I'm not a big history buff, but I guess I must be a culture buff, because I do quite like to hear stories from people who were in places that I wasn't, at times that I wasn't. I think those are valuable, and I think that a lot of that gets lost later. I mean, you have only to look at your own memory to see how distorted that gets after a week, a month, a year, 5 years, to understand why a cultural memory would get distorted. And I'm going to be speaking of things 10, 12 years ago in my past now. So already I've lost a lot of valuable context and accuracy, but I figure better late than never. It was around 2001, maybe. I was sitting on a subway car, reading a magazine that I'd managed to find at school or something. And the magazine it was a technical magazine, and there was an article in this magazine about some software called Shake. And the article, I believe, was interviewing people like Phil Tippett and Joe Letteri and other effects artists of the day. And it was specifically praising Shake and Unix, which was an operating system. I knew that much because my dad had told me about Unix. He said that Unix was sort of a big, sort of professional, industry-strength operating system that businesses and governments used. That was a long time ago. I heard about that. And I think he knew about it because of probably government and maybe university work or connections. So, and I had unknowingly encountered it myself, going on to a library system. It was the New York Public Library System. They had an online component where you could use this application or this thing called Telnet. And I didn't know what Telnet was. Nobody I knew what Telnet was. But there were instructions on the website, I guess, and you would do this thing on Mac OS X, and it would open up a window that looked like a text editor, but it didn't look like a text editor, or it didn't act like a text editor. And it would go to this Telnet thing, and you could actually interact with it and get a listing of books, of what books were in the library. You could browse the card catalog of the library through this interface. And I think you could see whether it was in, like, on the shelf or whether it was checked out as well. So it was a very useful thing. And that was, of course, Unix, but I didn't, or probably Linux, actually, but I didn't know it at the time. So I was in the subway reading this magazine that I'd found about this, about these visual effects artists who were praising Shake and Unix. And there was this quote, which I wish I still had, but it said something to the tune of, "We really like this software because you can launch, or you can use the software without starting, you can start a render without launching the application." I think that was what it was. You can start a render without launching the application, and I thought, or without having the application open, and I thought that sounded so magical, because I, at the time, was exploring a bunch of film-related things, and I knew, although at a very, very non-professional hobbyist level, but I knew how render times, just doing simple video actions at the time, it was very difficult, or rather, it wasn't difficult, I mean, it was difficult, but it was time-consuming, and so the idea of being able to do something, well, it was time-consuming and resource-intensive, and that was a big problem for me at this time, because I was trying to do bigger and bigger media projects on, shall we say, computer equipment that wasn't getting any younger. There was this Apple Mac, I think it must have been a G4, which even at the time was old anyway, I think, and, or maybe not. Maybe it wasn't that old, but either way, it was some computer, Apple Mac computer, and I remember that there was this third-party company that was selling sort of rogue CPU upgrades for the G4 computer. You could actually upgrade your CPU from this company, and it was not a simple process. You had to dismantle very important parts of your computer and plug this thing in, but it was a big deal, especially for a Mac user, because Mac generally frowns, culturally it frowns upon modifying or upgrading. It the business model of Apple is for your equipment to become obsolete as quickly as possible, so that you then must buy everything new. That is their business model. I'm not 100% sure that Apple at this point would even bother denying that. So it was their business model then as it is now. So I had this G4 with this third-party upgrade on it, and I was trying to get it to do things that it just didn't want to do, at least not quickly. And so I knew how painful it was to render media, render video, to process video, and this isn't high resolution video really. I mean, it was for the time, I guess, but I mean, this is, I guess, what we would have to call standard def now, which is funny because actually the new standard def is really high def. So it was 480p anyway. So we're not talking about anything too fancy here. And I just couldn't conceptualize how movies like The Lord of the Rings were being made, where they were high, film resolution essentially, and how that could ever work. And well, I mean, it worked barely, and part of the way that it worked was that that render farms were rendering these things, so it wasn't just one computer, and that certainly intrigued me as well. Now, ironically, around the same time, maybe a couple of years earlier, I was working at yet another computer store. I've worked at a couple of different computer stores, and I remember going down to the floor. I was a support person. I didn't deal with customers. But I went down to the sales floor on a break to have a browse, and I think I must have been in the Mac section, and I saw something called Yellow Dog. Yeah, I think it was just called Yellow Dog. It must have probably said Linux on there somewhere, but I saw Yellow Dog, and I thought that looked kind of interesting and wondered what it was. And it was weird because it didn't really say what it was. You know how you have in a software section, back when you had software sections in stores, you would have things like Office, Games, Creative, that sort of thing. This was just kind of off on its own, like they didn't know where exactly to put it. I think I seem to remember there also being a Red Hat and a Seuss box, but I could be wrong, and maybe that was in a different section. Either way, I saw these boxes, didn't know what they were. And then, time and time again, we would get calls there at the store with people asking about Linux, about either Red Hat, OpenSUSE, or I guess it was just called SUSE, and Yellow Dog. And it was so weird because it just seemed like it was all around colors, you know, Red Hat and Yellow Dog. I don't know, SUSE didn't really, I don't remember it actually having a color, but it did have a weird name, so that was good enough. And very frequently people would be almost aggressive about it. I mean, generally speaking, to be honest, this is a computer store in New York, so everyone was aggressive about everything, to be fair. But I do remember being a little bit annoyed by people who would ask specifically about these Linux things, because they would act like you were so dumb for not knowing what it was, and they would really, really insist that if you were smart, you would figure out what this is, because this was the future. And how could you not know that? So I remember getting a little bit of a bad taste for this thing, just based on sort of my few interactions. And furthermore, I didn't know what it was. And furthermore, I felt like it was a PC thing. And back in those days especially, there was this very solid division between Mac and PC. You were a Mac-branded Mac user, or you were a quote-unquote PC user, which meant not Mac. So that was just Mac or not Mac. And so I figured that Linux was a PC thing, and so I couldn't possibly be interested in that because I wasn't a Windows guy, I was a Mac guy. And again, no understanding that Linux was neither of those two things, or both of those things, if you look at it that way, hardware-wise. And so and furthermore, I didn't connect Linux with Unix, those two things. So I knew about Unix. I knew that it had good reputation, according to my father, and it had an amazing reputation in the industry that I was hoping to get into. Had no idea that it was the same thing as Linux. And you have to understand, this was early enough in sort of the internet days that you wouldn't just stumble across this information. There wasn't a place to go onto the internet. You wouldn't open your browser and just sort of find out, oh yeah, Unix, Linux, same thing. Oh, operating system replaces Windows or Mac OS. Okay, gotcha. You would have to go really, really find that stuff. And I think at the time it was probably a little bit early for me anyway, for me to have gone and really delve into Linux. I think I would have gotten lost very, very quickly. Not only because I was not really in, I wasn't, I felt like I was pretty good at computers, but I was nowhere near what I probably needed to be around computing. So it's good that I didn't explore any further, I think. Either way, it was there. It was a brush up against Linux that today I look back at and chuckle, because boy was I close. Boy was I close, but not quite. So after reading the article and sort of hearing about that world, that's what really made the lasting impression, was this idea that you could render video or video effects without launching an application. That just seemed like magic to me. That didn't seem possible. I mean, I would give anything to be able to do that without launching, for instance, the video editor that I was running at the time, or the photo editing application that I was using at the time. I just thought that sounded so magical, but alas, couldn't understand how it was possible, and so I kind of had to brush it off, put it out of my mind for a little while. So I'm at a different computer store working there, and this is on the opposite coast now. I'd moved to California by this time, and I was ostensibly working in the film business, but it's a gig economy, and so for steady income, I also had a part-time gig at a computer store, and I walked into the break room. People are on the computer, people are at the coffee maker, they're chatting. One of them is chuckling about how hackers had recently announced and posted online that they had loaded Doom onto an iPod. And that just seemed so ridiculous to me. I just felt like, why would you want to play Doom on an iPod? And yet I was very impressed. I thought, well, you know what? That's really cool. To be able to say that you've done that, that must be pretty satisfying. Didn't understand it. Thought it was pretty cool. And in the meantime, the other guy in there in the break room was saying how Firefox was a really nice browser. And I don't know how long it had been out at that time, but it probably was pretty early in its life, to be honest. And this had kind of, there was this weird time early in the early 2000s where the browser landscape got really, really dismal. Like, for a while, you had Netscape, I guess it must have been, and that seemed to be the thing that you would use. It worked. It was the sensible option. And then all of a sudden, sort of like, everybody else had a browser. Like, you could find a browser everywhere you turned, and yet none of them seemed to be any good. You know, you had, like, OmniWeb, I think, was one of them. You had, the Microsoft browser, Internet Explorer for Mac. You had Mozilla. Yeah, Mozilla and Netscape, I think Mozilla somehow, it was Netscape, and then it was Mozilla, and Mozilla had their own browser for a while or something. That wasn't branded Firefox. Or maybe it was branded Firefox, but someone had taken the code and built it just as Mozilla. I don't know. So you had a couple of different browsers, or a lot of them. Oh, and Opera, of course. And yet none of them seemed to be any good. And I did eventually. I settled into Opera for a little while. But I was just always trying to find, like, the right one, never finding the right one. And finally, someone mentioned Firefox. And I asked what was so good about it, and they kind of told me that it had extensions and tabs, had tabbed interface. And I tried it out, and it was amazing, and have been using it ever since. And very slowly, with that as an unofficial introduction to open source, very slowly, I started to understand that there was computer code out there that was just being made by other people. Up until that point, I think I'd felt like all computer code sort of, I don't know, either manifested itself or was either by Apple or Microsoft, maybe. I'm not really exactly sure what I thought about programs, but it never occurred to me that just normal people could up and decide to write code. And it wasn't really Firefox that introduced that idea to me. It was the Firefox extensions, because those did just seem like random people. And that seemed almost attainable to me. I mean, I'd seen software before that had been written by one or two people, I think. I mean, I'm sure I had. I think that was probably, I don't know that they were open source. I think it was more like shareware or something, or trial software or something like that. And you could tell it was like by a small group of people. It wasn't big business or whatever. But Firefox, the extensions particularly, you could just kind of tell that these were just people who yesterday, or, you know, last week they were doing websites, which still seemed pretty mysterious to me. They were just doing websites, but this week they decided to teach themselves how to program a Firefox extension. So that was kind of my brief glimpse of that. And I didn't take note of that either, honestly. But there in the computer store, there was a demo one day of how to make a podcast. And I have no memory of what that was about. It was in the background as I was, you know, actually working. But I kind of discovered through that there was an online movement of sort of actual people just making stuff for fun, whether it was media or applications or music. Well, like media, I guess I meant video, music, applications, whatever they wanted, really. And it was going onto the internet. And all of these ideas kind of, it had all culminated now. And I was starting to stumble upon lots of different examples of this. I mean, I discovered Blender and started using that as a potential alternate video editor. I discovered FFmpeg and was using that actively, both at work and so both at the computer store and at film gigs. I was using that very actively to transcode video that nothing else could transcode, because nobody else wanted to cooperate with one another. But FFmpeg had reverse engineered all of these codecs, or however they do their magic, and would make anything possible. And I was the one guy in a 5 mile radius, maybe, who knew how to do that. And so I made first a name and then money for myself, just really wielding FFmpeg. That was my claim to fame for not several years, but for a good year that lasted me. That was great. And I knew very much about I knew that FFmpeg was open source, and I knew Blender was open source. So those made a very powerful impact upon me, because I knew what I had found. I knew that I had found just some random people online making software and intentionally giving it away for free. And that's about all I knew about it. I mean, I got the sense that it was a collaborative effort, that there was a group behind all of this, and that it was kind of a collective, and that appealed to me as well, because I, as much as I don't think I'm a team player, I do think I'm a team player some in some ways. I think, you know, that collaborative effort toward a common goal for good appeals to me. So I knew that, and I really started to become aware of this open source ideal at that time. Now, my computer was quickly dying. It was just overheating. It was slow. I was asking way too much of it, and the software, of course, wanted to be updated, and the more you update, the slower the computer is able to perform, and it was not fit for purpose. It was very quickly proving itself to just not be appropriate for what I needed it to do. Problem was, I didn't have the money to get another Macintosh computer. That was not something that I could do. And around that time, it just a lot of different things were happening. There were lots of, I was really trying to get a job in film, and it wasn't really working out. And I just kept feeling like the computer was the thing that was standing in my way. And then one day, I think the hard drive up and died, and I took it into the service center or whatever, and this had been a new hard drive. I had just gotten the hard drive for to house, you know, video footage, and it had died, and it was a new hard drive, and the person at the service center just said, yeah, you know, hard drives, you can't really expect them to last any more than a year. And I just thought, well, that's a bald-faced lie. Like, a hard drive is supposed to last for longer than a year. And of course, all the data was lost. I think I did spend several hundred dollars to get the data recovered. I sent it into some specialist place, and they got a lot of the footage back and sent it back to me. But it was very expensive, probably a quarter of what a new computer would have cost me anyway, which would have had the hard drives in them. And so trying to, you know, cut costs ended up meaning that I had more costs, and it was just very frustrating. As you can imagine, as I'm sure you've probably even experienced. And so I knew that the trajectory that I was on was that I was going to have to get a new computer. And I was kind of resigning myself to that, basically being the end of, I guess, the trajectory that I, you know, the previous trajectory. I'd been ramping up, I felt, on a lot of different skills, making inroads into actual lucrative gigs in film, and now it was all falling apart. So I kind of made the unconscious decision, I think, to focus on computers for a while. And I didn't know it I didn't think about it at the time. I think I thought that was just, I just wouldn't be able to do as much on computers right now for film, and I would turn my attention to physical stuff on film. Because in the film world, there are those two worlds. There's the on-set stuff, and then there's the pre- and post-production stuff. Pre- and post is basically all computer. On-set is the, you know, you actually have to be there physically, doing stuff physically on set. So I just figured, okay, well, I'm going to transition from post over to on-set, which I love anyway, so that's fine. And so that's kind of what I decided to do, but not in so many words, because I didn't really know that that's what I was doing. You know how it is. You just know, well, I can't, this computer's useless to me. I'm going to stop spending as much time in front of the computer and start spending more time over here. And so that's what I kind of started doing. So as part of that, at the computer store that I was working at, they would have a lot of meetings. I don't know why, but they did. I was very bored during meetings, and so I decided, I'd read on the internet, which had, you know, this is years later, so the internet was actually fun and useful now, and so I read on the internet that you could play Tetris in a terminal on macOS, and I thought, well, that seems like a very handy trick to know. So I looked up how to do that, and it was this application called Emacs. Well, I didn't know it was an application. It's just, you type the word Emacs into a terminal. It launches a weird interface, and then you press, I think it was Escape, and then X, and then Tetris, and then return, and then you're playing Tetris. That's it. So I would do that during all of the meetings. When people would have meetings, I would sort of migrate to a display computer and casually start Tetris and start playing Tetris. And that was a lot of fun. That was great. It was a great thing to do. And through Emacs, I discovered that there was, I think, a view license file or something like that in Emacs. And I was reading a book, which I've mentioned before on the show, I'm sure, Visual Quick Start Guide to Unix. It was by Peach Pit Press, I think. Visual Quick Start Guide to Unix. People used to laugh at me because the people who knew what Unix was, well, who claimed to know what Unix was, thought, what's visual? What could possibly be visual about Unix? Because in their minds, it was just a bunch of commands typed into a black screen with green text. So they used to laugh at me for that. But I was reading that, and so I was getting to know more about the terminal. And as part of my sort of exercises and exploration of the terminal, I stumbled across all of the Emacs files in probably /user/share/Emacs, and one of those was the GNU public license. And so I read that, and that completely changed my mind about computing. It was like one of those documents that, I mean, I can still remember exactly where I was on the floor of my apartment when I opened that file and read it. It was just something that changed everything for me. It was a big, big deal. And it remains a big deal. I mean, the GPL remains a big deal. It is today, as of this recording anyway, in April 2021, it is still really the only copyleft license that protects the software users and developers from corporate exploitation. BSD license can't do that. It doesn't do that. MIT license does not do that. Apache license doesn't do that. It's the GNU public license that performs that provides that manner of protection, which I think is important, and I think it's going to become more important as we go further and further down this path of corporate involvement in the digital world. So I read that, and I realized that computing was ubiquitous enough at this point that it ought to be open source or free software. It ought to be open to everyone, available to everyone, and so on. So I started really, really investigating Linux, and I used to spend, I mean, it feels like it must have been 3 years of lunch breaks, but it wasn't. It was like probably 6 months of lunch breaks in the library, or the, I think it was a bookstore across the street from the computer store where I was working at the time. And I would just sit in the computer section reading everything I could get my hands on that said Linux on it. And there was a surprising amount of books about Linux at that bookstore. And a lot of those books had CDs in the back. And so I bought, I think it must have been, well, I don't remember what book it was, but it had a Mandriva CD in the back. And I took that Mandriva CD out of the book, and I purchased I borrowed a laptop, a PC laptop from someone. I followed the instructions in the book on how to boot off of this CD, which seemed like a crazy idea, and sat there and stared in awe of Mandriva Linux. It was amazing. It looked amazing. It looked different. It wasn't Windows. It wasn't Mac. It was this whole alternate universe of computing that I had no idea that it existed. And that was a big deal for me. I started listening to podcasts and, well, I was already listening to podcasts, to be fair, but I started listening to Linux podcasts. I had been consuming a lot of media about sort of hacking, hardware modding, things like that. But then I switched over to Linux, and the main one that I latched onto, of course, was Jess Griffin's Linux Reality. I say of course, because I actually later hosted an episode for that show, so that's why I said of course. So it was called Linux Reality. It was Jess Griffin, and he spoke a lot about Slackware. He spoke a lot about Fedora. For some reason, those are the two that I remember. I'm sure he spoke about a lot of other things too, but those are the two that sort of made an impression upon me. And this is kind of how I remember when I got into Linux, by releases. And the one that stands out to me for lots of reasons that I won't even discuss, actually, Fedora 7 is the one that I remember. Fedora 7 was just coming out when I was really getting serious about Linux. And by really getting serious, I mean I got a laptop, I installed Slackware Linux on it. Now, I remember that Fedora 7 had come out because I was debating, like, what should I put, what Linux should I use, as anyone does. And I knew that I wanted to use Slackware because Chess Griffin spoke about it so much. I imagine, I don't actually remember, but that's probably why I wanted to. And, you know what it was? Because everyone said, once you learn Slack, if you learn Slackware, you learn Linux. That was the saying, probably still is the saying. And so I said to myself, well, I want to learn Slackware. So I knew that I was going to put that on at least a partition of my drive. But I was doing a lot of school-related stuff at the time, it must have been school stuff. That doesn't make sense either. It must have been work stuff at the time. No, I think I must have been taking a class in something at the time, because I remember I had some school stuff that I needed to get done in order to pass. So I thought, well, I can't not have a reliable computer. I need something that will definitely boot and give me OpenOffice or whatever I needed at the time. So that has to happen. So I knew that I wanted sort of almost a backup partition. And I mean, it didn't even cross my mind to put Windows on that, because I don't do Windows. So I thought, well, I'll do some other Linux. And one of the contenders was Fedora 7. Now, I went through a bunch of different ones, and the deciding factor at that point, especially because this partition's job was to be the reliable one, I think that it was, I believe, Ubuntu, I don't know, something or another. And so that was on one partition, and Slackware was on the other partition. And I ended up booting into Slackware pretty much all the time. It was a lot less mysterious than I think I'd thought. Although, initially I did have to recompile the kernel in order to get wireless drivers. And you have to understand, I had no idea what a kernel was. I had barely just learned how to partition drives. So I was definitely in over my head, but I was just so excited about getting everything working and figuring this stuff out that I could not be stopped, apparently. Looking back, I think I would not advise myself to do the thing that I did. I would have definitely maybe done some things differently for fear of getting too overwhelmed, but apparently this was exactly what I needed and wanted, and that's what I went with, Slackware, and I think Ubuntu for a while at least, although I do know that I did run Fedora for a while as well. That other partition, because I ended up not using it that much, it did kind of become a sort of a rotating test space, which of course introduces a whole other set of problems, because then you're overwriting your MBR by your master boot record by accident or whatever. So that gets pretty messy, and it did. It got messy. It was not good that was what I did. I mean, like it made my life a lot more difficult than it needed to be. So there were a lot of reinstalls of Lilo on Slackware to get my partitions back. But I mean, that's the kind of thing where you're just learning. And so what ended up happening was, as I said, I started doing a lot more computing stuff just because that's where my passion was leading me at the time. And film work not only moved from post-production to on-set, it kind of got moved out entirely, because getting a job on set is really, really hard. There's a lot of in-person networking, and you got to get in with the right people, and you got to make friends so that they'll call you for the job and so on. I'm not very good at that. So it kind of got shuffled off to the side in favor of computing, because I was so captivated by this new puzzle that had been set in front of me, which was, here's a piece of hardware, now make it a computer that you love. And the requirements for that was that it was going to be, you know, non-corporate, and that it was going to be open source and custom made, like stuff that I wanted. I wanted the desktop to be a certain way, because I'd spent my whole life being told what the desktop was going to be by Apple Corporation, and I didn't want that anymore. And as far as I knew, Windows was the same sort of deal. Like, you didn't really have that much of a choice. I've heard since then that there were people who ported, like, Black Box and things like that to Windows. So I guess some people did some interesting things with that. Although, to be fair, I was running Enlightenment on my Mac before I did switch over to Linux. So as part of that, I mean, not as part of, but that Visual Peach Pit guide to Unix got me started well enough along the terminal path that I was able to discover the Fink project and Mac ports, which these are precursors, I guess, or maybe alternatives would be the better term, to the newer version of them, which is Homebrew, which a lot of people know, at least now in 2020. People, it seems to be fashionable if you're a Mac user to be a Homebrew user. And that's, you know, it's Homebrew is what they call it. It's as if though you're homebrewing something, but someone's homebrewing these build scripts, I guess, and it'll install Unix or Linux, let's call it Linux utilities, or Linux applications, the common stuff that you and I would know as Linux users, at least, on Mac. And so I did a lot through Fink Project and Mac ports and installed, for instance, the Enlightenment desktop, and I created a .xinitrc file that launched Enlightenment when I logged in, and I had this script that would kill all components of the Macintosh and just launch Enlightenment or something like that. So it was kind of ridiculous and cool and amazing. But after I discovered that I could boot Linux and run Linux proudly, the interest in sort of abusing Apple computers was really was substantially lessened, because then you just realize that all you're doing is playing inside of someone else's sandbox. And yes, you're making your own structures, and you're doing stuff that they didn't intend for you to do, but you're still in their sandbox. Whereas Linux, you weren't in anybody's sandbox. You were just, you know, you were wherever you wanted to be. You were out in the yard, or inside, or whatever. You were anywhere. So, yeah, once I switched over to Linux, I would say that my time on an Apple Mac just got got diminished drastically outside of stuff that I had to do at work. Although even then, it wasn't all Apple Mac at work within film post-production. There was a lot of stuff that was on. Well, I didn't know what it was on at the time. And looking back, I wonder if it was probably Linux, which checks out, because back in 2009, I think it was, I probably have it in the podcast somewhere. At some point, I went to a National Association of Broadcasters convention in Las Vegas, and I was talking to someone there who was demonstrating an Autodesk tool of some sort. It might have been Maya, maybe. And I noticed that it was running on Red Hat Linux. And I asked her about it. I said, "You're running this on Linux?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know. This is Maya." Like, all she knew was that the computer that they gave her to do her work on was a computer with Maya, and she had no idea what it was running on. I mean, I'm not making fun of that person. Not that it would matter, because we don't even know who she is. But I'm not, because I didn't know that Linux was an OS or that Mac OS was an OS. I didn't have the concept of what that meant. So it's not surprising that people wouldn't understand that, yes, there is a whole ecosystem running your computer. Like, there's a thing under that isn't hardware, but isn't the application that you're running. It's this other thing. And that's such a mysterious space for so many people. And I think that's, you know, one thing that it's a weird thing. Once you learn it by understanding what Linux is, then suddenly your understanding of the computer shifts in a seemingly unimportant way, but it is actually a huge and major shift. That's how I got into Linux. Hopefully that was somewhat historically accurate and painted a picture of something. I don't know what exactly, but I think it does paint a picture. And yeah, I think it's important to kind of remember these things, remember these slices of time, because things do change really fast. I mean, I'm sure things change fast in the real world, but in computing especially, it changes so much. And you can hardly even sort of remember that it used to be different until you really, really think. And then you're thinking about these things and you're like, yeah, that was so different then, you know? And sometimes they're not better, and sometimes they are better. It just kind of depends. Like, the internet, I think, started out pretty bad, and then it got better, and then it hit its peak, and then it got worse. Linux probably started out pretty bad. Luckily, I missed that part. And then it got really good, and then it got better. So, for instance, I wouldn't want to go back even 3 years in Linux time. Like, why would I want to do that? I'll jump forward 3 years, see where we are. That'd be cool. But, yeah, I wouldn't want to go back. Whereas maybe for something like the internet, maybe, yeah, I would want to go back pre-what we called at the time Web 2.0. You know, the comment section, the user-generated internet, supposedly. It's good and bad, whatever, or indifferent sometimes. It's just interesting to sort of see the digital culture and the digital subculture and what is now, of course, just kind of the prevalent culture, I guess. So that's Linux up until 2020 for me, I guess. Well, to be fair, I only got up to about, 2009 at NAB. But yeah, Slackware pretty much consistently throughout, with a lot of Fedora there sprinkled, you know, throughout. Because Fedora was just that was the exciting one. Slackware was the intentionally boring one, still is, and Fedora is still the exciting one. It pushes the envelope, and my tolerance for that certainly has shifted away from enjoying pushing the envelope, but I think, obviously, that it's important to have that out there. Someone needs to be doing it, and it's cool that it's still Fedora. All right, that's it. This has been episode 404. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for finding it. Hey, if you did find this episode, shoot me an email. I'll be interested in seeing whether anyone ever hears this. We'll find out. Thanks. Bye. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order Ogcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually, in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation, .org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Friend. or new world of adventure. You will be putting down that drink and stepping away from your tiki bar. You've won a discount tour of beautiful Poseidon. Come see the whole world. Like Pandora's Box, once you open Snaehang Shu's boat tours, you'll have difficulty closing it again.
Wow.
Our new schooner, Beautiful Lady of the Sea, will take you to your dreams come true. Call us today to book your appointment.